Hey, Will, like I normally do, I just want to take a moment to tell our listeners to make sure they hit us up on social, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, wherever you might see us. Make sure you're sending us something. Also, you can email us directly at appalachiameetsworld@gmail.com. If you get a moment, shoot us a line, give us some feedback.
Yeah, and wherever you listen to the podcast, make sure you subscribe to Appalachia Meets World. It just helps our podcast, but it also helps you know when we're releasing a new episode.
But if economic development is fundamentally about connections and fundamentally about bringing people into connection who have historically not been in connection, that's kind of my jam right there.
Appalachia Meets World, a podcast about place and perspective, but always Appalachian.
And don't forget, Will, tonight's episode is powered by SOAR.
Shaping our Appalachian region. If you're an entrepreneur out there, especially in Eastern Kentucky, check them out.
Appalachia Meets World. We're back another week. It's Will.
And Neil, what's up?
Glad to have you back this week.
Just like everybody else in America out here grinding. Yeah. I apologize to the listeners.
Other than like the tornadoes that we've seen the last couple of days, I just assume this beautiful spring weather just kept you away.
My second favorite time of the year, I guess. I can't lie, fall is my favorite, but you know, this spring season leading into all the great things that we have going on in my neck of the woods and in the great state of Kentucky over the next couple of days, weeks. You know, it is a fabulous time of year. And when the weather shines like it has been this past week, man, it just makes everything come together nicely.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. It's Derby Week.
That's right, baby. How can I not mention it? Are you serious? What kind of Kentuckian do you think I am?
Exactly. Do you have a horse for us?
I don't have one picked out just yet, man. I'm still doing my homework. It's early. You know, I know it's the eve, Derby Eve, but it's early for us Derby junkies. I'll have my horse picked, you know, at least an hour before the race.
An hour
How about
before?
You?
I have a favorite.
Okay, well, you know, you got some insight for me? Go ahead. This is how I put together my thoughts. I listen to everybody else.
Well, the favorite is fierceness. I kind of like juvenile, but as a long shot, I've been hearing a lot of good things about Honor Marie.
Okay, is that the one? Who's the owner of that one?
So Whip Beckman's the trainer. I usually don't look at the owners. I usually look at the trainers. I like Pletcher horses. Or I look at the jockeys. Jose Ortiz is on one this year. I'm gonna bet on his horse regardless. I always bet on Ortiz.
He's like the modern day Pat Day, right?
I guess you could say that. You think our listeners know who Pat Day is?
I hope so. That's a great question. That's a great, great question. To me, Pat Day is, I don't know. I hate to say best ever, but in my mind he is. I don't know if he goes down in the history books as the greatest of all time in the horse racing world, but if I'm naming them, that's who's at the top of my list.
I know it's different for Kentuckians, but just for you, like, is the Derby a special day for you? Like, do you celebrate every year, regardless of where you are?
Yeah, I can't remember a time that I didn't watch the Derby, but I tell you what, man, having these kids, you know, and these kids playing baseball.
On Derby
these
Day.
These baseball coaches really do not respect the Kentucky Derby, and it bothers me. It should be a sacred day.
It should. You think it's the greatest 2 minutes in sports?
Oh, 100%.
100%.
No question. What other 2 minute sport is there, first of all? For you to say it's the greatest 2 minutes in sports, I mean, occasionally a football game comes down to the last 2 minutes. Right.
But their 2 minutes lasts 25.
Right.
Derby exactly. Is a true 2 minutes. I do recall that you and I have been to a derby together And I don't think we ever saw a horse that day.
We did not. And I actually can't remember that you actually recall it. So I'm glad that you do have memory of that day.
I wanted to ask you one last Derby question. Are you a fan of the mint julep? Now that's an important question for all Kentuckians. So I got to ask, are you a fan?
Can I be honest?
Absolutely.
Is anybody going to judge me?
Absolutely.
That's what I was afraid of. No, I'm not a fan of the mint julep. I know it's tradition. I understand, but it is not good, man. I don't know that I've ever had one and taken that sip and been like, that is fantastic. I don't know. Maybe I don't have a palate for it.
And there's a bar in D.C. It's in the bottom of, I can't not remember the hotel, but it's right there across from the White House where one of the first mint juleps was supposedly introduced there in D.C. It's a famous bar. When I think of the name, I'll put it in the show notes, but Henry Clay actually introduced the mint julep. But I have to tell you, Neil, I'm glad you said that because first, I'm not a mint person. Like, I don't like Thin Mints, Girl Scout. I'm just not a mint person. So if you're not a mint person, of course you're not really going to care for a mint julep. I drink them every Kentucky Derby day, but that's the extent of my experience with the mint julep. You're right. I just don't care for them all that much.
It's forced, though, right? Like, it's a forced. Like, you drink it because you feel like you have to.
Like you said, it's tradition.
Yeah. So the biggest app news of the week is the fact that the greatest 2 minutes in sports are happening this weekend. But besides that, do you have any other app news for us, Will?
Considering the greatest 2 minutes is in Louisville, a little bit outside of the region. Yeah, I got some app news to bring us back home. I just got a little bit. I wanted to mention, because we had this guest on previously, Connect Humanity, who helps bridge the digital divide throughout the country. They're a nonprofit, but they started the IDEA Fund, really to fund local internet service providers or ISPs that have difficulty accessing capital. They've helped with this IDEA Fund. I wanted to mention it because Microsoft has just partnered with Connect Humanity to provide them some private capital for this fund, which is really big for them. I wanted to mention that. Another little piece, Governor DeWine in Ohio just announced $154 million to go towards improving recreational opportunities and quality of life in 12 communities in Appalachia, Ohio. Another couple of things, PBS has this docuseries that's out. It's called The Expressway with Dula Hill. It follows Dula Hill as he speaks with creative change makers in their local communities. And episode 2 that just came out on the 30th of April is all about Appalachia. And it follows Amethyst Kai. And if you've never heard of Amethyst, she's an incredible new up-and-coming singer. We'll actually play one of my favorite Amethyst Kai's songs at the end of this episode. But she's from East Tennessee. Actually, she grew up in Chattanooga. She went to school at East Tennessee State, attended college there in Johnson City, and studied, much like your man, Neil, Kenny Chesney. She studied bluegrass, old time, and country music, and she still remains in Johnson City. And she's definitely an up-and-comer. People are starting to know who she is. She's on this docuseries. It's just a really cool show, and episode 2 is all about Appalachia. So check that out. We'll put it in the show notes. And speaking of music, I wanted to mention SOAR, Shaping Our Appalachian Region, just announced their Country Music Highway Tribute Show. They started it last year. This is the second year, and they released the dates June 1st. It's going to be in downtown Russell, July 13th. Downtown Louisa, and August 2nd and 3rd in downtown Ashland. We're going to post that in the show notes. Go to the Facebook page, share it, like it. They have their own website. It's cmhtributeshow.com. And so that was the last little bit of app news that I had, Neil, but I wanted to end it with the Country Music Highway Tribute Show. If anybody's in that area over those 3 days over the summer, June 1st, July 13th, and August 2nd and 3rd, the first one in Russell, they just released the lineup. It's Bobby and Teddy Cyrus headlining the Country Music Highway Tribute Show. It's really to kind of celebrate the country music highway that everyone knows about, Highway 23 there that runs through eastern Kentucky. Bobby and Teddy Cyrus are the headliners. That is the relatives of Billy Ray Cyrus, who comes from East Kentucky. So I wanted to mention that, Neil, and that's all I have for that app news.
Well, that just warms my achy breaky heart, baby.
There you go.
Appreciate you you letting our listeners know what's going on around the area. So lots of great stuff coming up, and hopefully you'll learn a little bit more about it just by listening to us. So
speaking of learning quite a bit, I know that in the past we spoke with Nathan Oley of the IEDC, but we talked about the Economic Recovery Corps Fellowship that I'm doing. And as part of that, we plan on having one fellow on a month at the first of the month. This episode, it's with Mick Thornton. He is been placed in a host community in Utah. And we're going to talk to him today about why he applied, his experience with the fellowship, what he hopes to gain, his project there in Utah, and just all things Mick Thornton.
I'm looking forward to it, man. I get this question all the time back home. You know, how's your brother doing? What's your brother up to? I often try to, you know, tell him about you and what's going on and all the cool things that you're involved with. But this is one particular organization that you're involved with as well. It's how you met Mick. And I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more about him myself and all the great stuff he's doing in a different part of our country. Without further ado, man, let's get into it.
All right, let's get him on here. I'm glad you mentioned that other part of the country. You know, we wanted to, since my host site is in eastern Kentucky and I'm working there in eastern Kentucky, you know, we wanted to compare the regions like we often do on this show. So like you said, let's just get him on here. On the episode today, we have a special guest, Mr. Mick Thornton. He is a self-described builder of all things. Over his career, he's been a pastor, a radio producer, a writer, an app designer, a trauma consultant, a grant writer, a program designer, and counting. He's currently, like myself, an Economic Recovery Corps Fellow with the International Economic Development Council, serving in San Juan County, Utah. And Mr. Thornton, or Mick, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to be on the show today.
My pleasure, Will. You're a good guy. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Like I mentioned, you are an Economic Recovery Corps Fellow like myself. And so that's really why we wanted to have you on the show. We want to have a different fellow on at least once a month to talk about what you're doing, where you're doing it, but also why you're doing it and what the engagement has been like, just to learn a little bit about the work, but also about yourself. So I'll start with the first question that we ask anyone that's on our podcast, really important question. Like most Appalachians, Neil and I, our family, we're big on history, big on tradition. One of the traditions we have appetizers at the holiday, this gigantic spread of food, appetizers bigger than the meal. So we wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite appetizer or maybe just holiday dish?
Oh man, So I'm from Southern Oklahoma originally, where one of the rules in my family was the kids couldn't get too near the Thanksgiving table for fear somebody might get hurt when the rush started, right? So man, I love food, and I've traveled a lot too. So I love I'm a really adventurous eater. I'm trying to narrow it down to one thing as you're talking, and this is not an appetizer, but the thing that comes to my mind right now as far as just soul food. So ham and beans and cornbread. Only the deal is you take the cornbread and you got to crunch it up in the ham and beans, right? It's not two things, it becomes one thing. And then you put some honey in it, and
Honey.
then you you top it off with garlic salt. And I'm telling you, man, that will change your life. You get yourself like a cold, rainy, miserable, yucky old day, and you got ham and beans in the crock pot. That cornbread comes out, and you crunch it up, put in that honey and that garlic salt. Oh my goodness, that's where it's at for me.
That's incredible. Minus the honey and garlic salt, that's probably not far removed from my favorite meal of all time. So I don't know what type of beans you're talking about, but where I come from, soup beans are a big deal, which essentially are pinto beans, but we call them soup beans. Crumble up some cornbread, put some onions in there. Some people put some relish. I don't, but that's my favorite meal of all time, soup beans and cornbread.
Relish. I like that. I'm going to try that.
There you go. I'll try the honey and garlic salt, and then we'll compare.
Right on.
We've had Nathan Oley, the executive director of IEDC, on to talk about the fellowship. So our listeners kind of have a general understanding of the fellowship, but I wanted to ask you, what made you want to apply to be a fellow?
Oh my goodness. So I came kind of sideways into this work, which I tend to come sideways into pretty much everything I do. So that probably makes sense. I would say, first of all, I appreciated that podcast with Nathan. Even having done all the training we've done and been to the things that we've done, hearing you and he have that conversation brought me even more clarity, and was really good for me. So I appreciated that. So shout out to anybody who hasn't listened to that conversation, go back and do it. So the way I came into the conversation is I've been working in Northwest Kansas for about the last 5 years, doing two different things. One of them is working on a grant with about 19 different school districts, helping them do a better job of working with kids who've been through hard things, and more helping educators process their own hard stuff because, the hard stuff inside of us tends to come out of us in hard ways. And that's important, especially if you're working with kids. And the other thing I've been doing is working with kids in the criminal justice system. We designed a program to provide trauma processing services for kids in the criminal justice system. And then that expanded to working also with their parents. And that program is now expanding again, another kind of sideways step into maybe working with foster kids and foster parents and bio parents of foster kids. So that was really the headspace I was in when I got this email from somebody, because I'm on 1,000 different, email lists to find out about grants and whatever. And I got this email about this Economic Recovery Corps opportunity. And I actually wrote both sides of the application. So for people who don't understand the way the program is designed, it's a locally designed economic initiative coupled with really a nationally supported workforce development. And so I wrote a host site application that I wanted to, in Western Kansas, create restorative work environments, because so many people, carrying hard things, go out into life, into work life, and everywhere else, and respectfully, they just can't hack it, right? I mean, if getting out of bed in the morning is easy for you, it's really hard to understand people who can't get out of bed in the morning. If staying sober is easy for you, it's really hard to understand people who can't stay sober, that kind of thing. And so I wanted to create an environment where we not only created the opportunity for people to do great work, but for people to grow and become more whole in the same space. So that was kind of my concept. And the truth is, I didn't write it very well. I was kind of on a timeline. And it got shot down, but then I went into the other side also and applied to be a fellow. So my thought was that if the host site comes through and the fellow site comes through, then all the, little weird work things I've been doing the last couple of years might kind of have this point of completion. And so that was sort of how I came in. My host site application got shot down pretty quick, and rightly so. But my fellowship application, they just kind of kept sending me these emails. Hey, answer these questions for us. Hey, why don't you do a, record yourself doing an interview? Hey, why don't you take a phone call? Hey, why don't you do a video interview? And it was all, you know how it is. It's all happening in the scope of all the rest of life. All of a sudden, this moment happens. Well, it was over Thanksgiving. I get an email from the Economic Recovery Corps, and it's the thanks but no thanks email, right? They say, hey, appreciate your time, appreciate your interviews. I'd interviewed with a few host sites at that point, and they're like, we don't think we're gonna need you. Yeah, so I said, okay, and went on with my life, traveled on to Florida with my wife and kids. We travel full time, or have for the last couple years, and which has been amazing. And we've been in Florida for 2 days. And I got an email from the ERC saying, hey, why don't you apply, or why don't you have a conversation with these couple sites? And one of them I didn't, and one of them I did, and had that conversation with a lady named Elaine here in San Juan County, Utah, and it was magnificent. It was one of those moments where I met somebody that I knew I could do great work with, and she met somebody she knew she could do great work with, and that was it, man. So couple
Very,
days later, we were packing up the rig and heading it back to the middle of the country.
very cool. Very cool. I didn't realize that. That's good to know. I also want to talk to you a little bit later on about your RV experience and traveling throughout the country. We talked a little bit about your background in your bio when I read it, but you don't have the typical path into economic development, needless to say. But economic development is very broad. People really don't understand what economic development is because it could be a lot of things. And I think that's the beauty of this fellowship, that it's brought together an incredibly diverse array of individuals to really do this transformational work. How do you think your experience, your background has prepared you for this position?
Oh, that's a good question, Will. I think first and foremost, I don't really have a background that points directly into anything at this point, right? I was my plan was to be a lawyer and a politician, believe it or not. I
Oh,
was
wow.
14 years old and wanted to be the president of the United States of America. And early, right about that same time in my life, I'm a person of faith. My faith is very important to me. And right about that time, I felt very specifically called into pastoral ministry. And my answer was no, I got a plan, right? So after a few messy years, I ended up with a political science degree. And then instead of going to law school, I went to seminary. And I think how all of that translates into this space is exactly in the way that you're talking, that economic development, if we're going to do it well at this stage where we're at, sort of developmentally, I think as a country, has to be understood more broadly than we tend to understand it. If economic development is the art and science of bringing a Walmart to your town, or getting getting whatever big name business of whatever stripe to come in so that, they bring jobs, they bring whatever, then the truth is, I'm not your guy. I just don't know much of anything about that. But if economic development is fundamentally about connections and fundamentally about bringing people into connection who have historically not been in connection, that's kind of my jam right there. That's my passion. That's my heart. I mean, to see people who aren't being seen, to care about people who aren't being cared about, and then to do the work of figuring out what it looks like to create space for them in the rest of life, and help them create space for themselves. That's beautiful to me. And economic development, from my opinion, is a fundamental part of that conversation, because the truth is that if you, whatever else is going on in your life, and whoever else loves you, and whatever other, protective factors you have going on, if you are poor, if you do not have things that you need to be okay, If the only house that you can be in is covered in so much mold, you have to keep the windows open even in the winter so your kids don't get sick all the time, right? You got to have a car to get around, but you can't afford a car to get around. If all of these things are fundamental parts of your life, it is really hard for you to be okay in ways that other people are okay. And it is really hard for you to be a part of the world in ways that other people are a part of the world. So I think my experience and my passion for serving people who have that lived experience is probably what brought me into this work, as near as I can tell, because you're right, my resume is all over the place.
No, but that's very well said. You kind of sound like a preacher.
I wonder where that comes from.
I wanted to kind of dive into that a little bit further, and we will, but I first wanted to ask you, since we're having you on in regards to the fellowship, just I mentioned where you're serving, San Juan County, Utah, but just what is your project? What is your current role
Sure.
there?
So San Juan County, Utah is the county that inhabits southeastern Utah. Okay. It is the biggest county in Utah. It is the most impoverished county in Utah. It overlaps the bottom third of the county overlaps with Native American reservation land. And the project is affordable housing. So here's the story of San Juan County. It's huge. It's traditionally impoverished. 92% of the area of the county is not public land or is not private land. So it's either BLM land or national park land or reservation land or something. And the other side of that is it is magnificently beautiful here. Like I can look in one direction and see, I can literally see different mountains in all four directions. And then plus that, I'm in the desert. So it's just this beautiful place where the desert Southwest and the Rocky Mountain region kind of meet each other. So what's happened is that it's a place that has a sort of lackluster rural economy with California house prices. It's how that all comes together now. So to give you an idea, the average family income in San Juan County is $52,000 a year. A report came out last week that said for a person to buy a median priced house in Utah, you needed to have a household income of $132,000 minimum. And that number has gone up 70% in the last 4 years. So it's
Wow.
not like it's a stable problem. It's like it's an insane problem that is becoming more insane by the moment. And that's the space that I've been invited into to work is what does it look like to help communities find affordable housing solutions in a very, very complex sociopolitical and economic environment like that?
And I mentioned, this transformational change that this fellowship could have, but I don't think the intent of the fellow is to come in and to be the answer, to be the
Right.
silver bullet to the challenges that are in San Juan, Utah. No one knows San Juan, Utah like the people of San Juan, Utah. There's no outsider that's going to come in and give them all the answers. But what do you see as your role, as a fellow?
You know, I'm so glad that you said that, Will, because that's exactly the fear that I feel about half the time. I mean, I'm in that place where half the time I'll wake up in the morning and be like, what in the heck am I doing here? And then the other half the time I wake up in the morning and be like, I got this. And the half of the time that I wake up and say, what in the heck am I doing here? Is the half where I wake up thinking I'm supposed to be here to solve this situation. Because the truth is, I don't have what it takes to do that. It's the half of the time that I wake up knowing that this is a large, spread out rural community that has a lot of history and a lot of history together. And a lot of history of finding solutions together. That's the part where I feel good about, because the thing that I am good at is helping people connect with one another and then connecting those people maybe to opportunities and people and thought process that they don't have yet. And that's really what I see as my role. My role is not to, show up and make it rain, if you will. That's not what it's gonna be. It's not like I'm gonna roll out of here in 30 months. And there are going to be 10 housing additions with streets named after me. Like that is not my role. And frankly, I have no interest in playing that kind of role. my role is in helping very, very busy people who are living very, very full lives to create space to maybe have a different kind of conversation to solve a problem that hasn't been solved yet.
And I imagine from that statement that that's kind of what you see as success looking like over the next 2.5 years. But from a personal perspective, maybe from your own development, what do you hope to get out of the next 2.5 years?
So my passion is creating safer space for people to be okay, right? Whether we're talking about the trauma processing groups that we've designed, or whether we're talking about classroom environments, and very much when we're talking about housing opportunity, right? And I think for me, as far as my what I hope to gain personally through this fellowship in the next couple of years is the capacity to help create that safe space in a broader context, and really be able to bring that conversation into economic development. There's a lot that I need to learn and understand to be able to have that conversation more fully. And there are a lot of people that I need to know that I don't know yet in order to really have that conversation effectively. And I see this fellowship as a pathway to both those things.
I've talked often on this podcast of why we started the podcast, to dispel some of the misconceptions that people have about Appalachia. But the thing that I've learned, and the thing that my brother has learned from doing this podcast, is that whether we're in Appalachia or in other regions, we share many more similarities than we do differences. A lot of the challenges that you mentioned there in San Juan, Utah, are the same challenges that are in Appalachia, that are in the Delta, that are in the inner cities. The challenges often look the same. What kind of challenges have you come across in your short time there?
Challenge one is communication, right? That there are a lot of busy people doing a lot of things that sort of overlap. And there are a lot of more or less agencies that kind of cover more or less the same spaces, that have a lot of funding streams and goals and problems for that matter, that they think they own. And as a result of that, it's really hard for people to talk to one another. And then in this particular space, coupled with there's a historic racial divide that's built around, you know, that goes all the way back to, I mean, colonialism, right? Yeah. And so much so that as recently as 2017, there was, federal legal involvement to get some, you know, lines redrawn so that political representation is maybe more representative of the demographics of the county, those sorts of things. So, and those things obviously come with a lot of hardship, and a lot of that tends to express itself in communication and trust. And so communication, I would put very high on the list. I don't think we can have this conversation without talking about poverty. And the thing about poverty is that poverty is not a unifaceted experience. Even the word is unifaceted, right? Because when we talk about poverty, what we define that is something like a lack of economic resource, right? But the experience of poverty is so much more full than that. And I say that as a person who I'm a first generation poverty escapee, right? Both my parents grew up in poverty. And so my life happened as I was watching my parents go from, you know, the trailer park to a whole different kind of economic experience. And so I don't think we can have a conversation, especially about affordable housing, without recognizing that poverty is really complicated, really multifaceted. And even the word itself, and a particularly conversation about the experience of poverty, wakes up a lot of things in a lot of people. And that's a really big deal, and just hard.
I mentioned that you've traveled around through in an RV over the last couple of years. I wanted to ask you about that, how that came to be, but also what you've seen as you've traveled across the country in regards to the similarities of different regions that you've been in or places that you've been in.
So how it came about, we we lived in the same little town in northern Nebraska for 15 years. For the first 12 of those, I was a senior pastor of a church. And then the last three, I was transitioning into this work and working primarily remotely anyway. I wasn't working in Nebraska. I just built an office in my garage, and that's where, you know, that's where all my Zoom meetings were happening, and I'd, you know, travel and whatnot. And there came this moment where it became very clear to my wife and I that it was time to go for us, and it was time to go for our kids, because we didn't feel like they were in a place where they were ever going to just fit in, you know what I mean? Like, and it was becoming more and more clear by the day, in a place that takes like 2 years for a house to sell, just to give you some context. We're like, you know what? We just put our house on the market, see what happens. So we put our house on the market on a Friday afternoon. But, you know, the realtor came over and we signed the papers or did whatever we did. I left the state to go do what I do. And it's 8 a.m. Monday morning. My wife is texting me as I'm, you know, presenting at a conference somewhere. And she's like, hey, realtor's here. She brought people. They're offering full price for the house. They don't want us to show it to anybody else. What do I do? What do I do? And I'm like,
you're the anomaly.
I'm working, baby. You just got to stall. I don't know what to do. Like, and it literally happened that quick. And within a matter of, I don't know, 60 days, bought a camper, bought a pickup, closed on our house, and just kind of got spat out into this life. It just happened. And the other side of that is we didn't feel it all settled where it was time to go to. And we've always loved to travel. So we just decided that we kind of had this golden window and we took it. We have our kids are a little older than yours. They're currently 16, 14, and 10. We just kind of took off. It's been exactly the adventure that we needed. I obviously have been working full time from the camper during that. So the truth is they have seen some things that I haven't seen, but I'm at peace with that, you know. we basically did kind of a spiral around the country. We went from Nebraska to Chicago. It was fall. So then we followed the fall leaves from Chicago all the way down to the Great Smoky Mountains. Then we came across Alabama, Arkansas, into Texas, up to Oklahoma, across Arizona, New Mexico, into Southern California, 5 miles from Mexico, spent 9 months going all the way up the West Coast, ended 5 miles from Washington. Somewhere in the northern part of that trip is when I started having these conversations about the ERC. Over last fall, we went from Washington State to Florida over the course of a couple months. And then that kind of puts us back into the story of where we found out we were headed back here. So then we zigged back over to southern Texas to ride out the worst of the winter. And now we're here. We've seen forest. We have seen mountains. We've seen desert. Had to have all the front end components of my truck replaced somewhere around Yosemite because I've been on so many terrible roads with our giant camper.
Oh, have you stayed in communities long enough to see similarities between or differences?
We have. So two things that have been amazing to me about this journey. Number one is we've made amazing friends. That there's everywhere you go, there's a community, and that includes on the road. We've made friends of traveling families who we'll be, you know, three states apart and know where each other are at, and we'll all rendezvous somewhere for a while and then go our separate ways again. And it's actually a really pretty diverse community that we've made in that sense. The other thing that has been amazing to me is everywhere I've gone, I've met amazing people. I'll walk out into whatever campground we're in and I'll look around and it will occur to me, if I need to build a rocket, I'll bet I could go door to door and find the right people with the right skill set to build a rocket. If I need to build a house, if I need to, like, it's all right here all of the time. And the thing that inhibits us is not our capacity to do, it's our capacity to connect. And that's been really fundamental for me. So we come from a very, very conservative, like deep red area of a deep red state. And people were terrified for us when we left. Like, they were convinced that we were going to be, you know, like eaten by zombies in downtown Portland or whatever happens to, you know, conservative Midwesterners when you branch out into the world. And the truth is everywhere we've been has been delightful. We've met wonderful people. The story that we tell ourselves and the story that is true is not the same story. And that's really important.
That's so refreshing to hear. With all the divisiveness that we see today, especially in the media, in the news, which You know, like I said, we started this podcast to distract from what the media says about Appalachia. With all this divisiveness that we hear, it's refreshing to hear that as you travel, the one thing that you see are the great people that are throughout this country, no matter where they come from or where they reside.
Yep. I have made more friends of color than I ever had in my previous life because I lived in very demographically homogeneous areas, right? It was me and a bunch of other bald white guys. You know, the difference was that, you know, they're all farmers and ranchers and I'm whatever the heck I am. That was the difference, right? So to be in areas that cross all of the lines that I'm told can't be crossed has been beautiful. I have been more well loved in a little Hispanic church in Hollister, California than probably anywhere else in the country in years and years. Like all of the lines that we think are real melt when we have the courage to show up as our authentic selves and when we can create safe space for other people to just be who they are, where they are. And I have been tremendously encouraged by that, as well as frankly, Will, as well as heartbroken. Because one of my conclusions that I've come to over our 18 months of travel is that we are not an advanced society. I used to think we were an advanced society because I've literally watched rockets launch and land within 8 minutes, which is crazy to me, right? Rocket launches up, shoots up a whole bunch of Starlink satellites, which is what we're talking through right now, and then lands on a pad somewhere else. Like, to me, that used to mean advancement. But what I've come to understand that is that until we can hear each other, we're not advanced. Until we stop hurting one another, we are not advanced. As long as the number one thing that holds us back is our capacity to connect, then we are, in a very real sense, a primitive people. And my hope is that we're able to create space to outgrow that. And that's part of what I'm excited about the whole ERC approach, is it's even an approach towards economic development that I think is designed to heal those divides. And that's exciting to me.
Great perspective. And I'm glad you shared, and I'm glad we kind of got into that area. I wanted to ask you, you know, I mentioned, and you have mentioned that you were a pastor, but you also, as I mentioned in your bio, were a radio producer. I failed to mention that you had your own radio show for a while, Mix Minute. I wanted to ask you about that because it's so incredibly interesting to me. You have your own website and people can check it out. I'll let you mention that. But how did that come to be, and what was the intent of Mix Minute?
So I backed in sideways to mixminute.com, and pretty much the same way I backed in sideways to everything else. It started as a way to invite people to church, right? Yep. I was the senior pastor of this, fairly small church in a little town. And there are always people out there that you're not connecting with. And that's the myth of rural life, right? The myth of rural life is that everybody knows everybody. And that is not true. The truth of rural life is that everybody has their tribe, their family system, their core group, and that there's a lot of overlaps between those core groups. But there are mountains of people out there that you actually have never even met. And so as we're processing that and wanting to be the kind of church that truly was open to anybody who would show up, you know, we had a little radio station in town. I was like, hey, I can probably do that. So, I mean, I had no microphone. I had no anything when I started. I would type up a message, read it into my computer, send off the MP3 file to the local radio station. And from there, it kind of became a thing. You know, people liked it. I spent more time at it. Pretty soon it kind of moved over. There was a nearby community that had that was a home base of a network of radio stations. I ended up over there. And then it ended up, that I would do two versions a week because there was the regular version, which was, 90 minutes or 2.5 minutes or 3.5 minutes, whatever it was, because people didn't care. You know, it wasn't a huge deal that I hit a particular time break. And then I would have to rewrite that and re-record that into a version that was exactly, 59.5 seconds long. And, and then I'm contracting with a guy that I know to create a background track, and then this thing, and then that thing. And it just sort of happened, man. And I think that's part of what's beautiful about life, right? Is that if you, when it goes right, what you really do is you find ways to passionately be your most true self. And then you, rather than becoming rigid around that, you keep an open enough mind to let your most true self flow through whatever door or out whatever window it does, and just see where things go. And for me currently, where things have gone is I'm sitting in a fifth wheel in San Juan County, Utah, trying to find a place to live.
So interesting and cool. It's kind of like two kids that started a podcast. things just develop if you give it time. But I wanted to mention to people that they can listen to some of your past episodes at mixminutes.com. Is that still?
Singular. Yeah. Mixminute.com. I will tell you it's not something I'm really doing anymore. There are some reruns out there that get played, but they're welcome to check out the website. I wrote a little book during that season. I'm pretty sure I got a link on the website for that too.
Nice. I don't think I mentioned author in the bio. So that to the self-described builder of all things. But I also wanted to ask you, speaking of builder, and since you're the first fellow that I've had on the episode, I wanted to ask you about the Good Talk app. Is it still in business, and what is it, and how can people find out about that?
Sure. It's still in different stages of development. It's out there. You should be able to get it in either the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store. So the Good Talk app started as a part of the trauma processing work that we were doing with kids in the criminal justice system. People heard what we were doing, and all of a sudden I'm, you know, traveling to different places, talking about this work and really having to distill it into a conversation that anybody could have with anybody. And that conversation was pretty simple and pretty structured. And I have a son who loves to code, and he has, he's been coding since he was 9 years old. And I mean, he's legit. And that was a way that I could share my work with him, and that we could build something cool together. Cause it's one thing to build cool things. It's totally a different thing to build cool things with cool people that you want to hang out with. And it's a next level entirely to have the opportunity to build cool things with your child. Right. And awesome. So that's where the Good Talk app came about. I got to sit in Zoom meetings just like this with a graphic designer with my son on his computer in his corner of the basement, whatever, you know, and get to hear him like all of a sudden just like switch languages. And all of a sudden they're talking about things. I have no idea what any of this is. And it was magnificent. And so that was the origination of the Good Talk app. The most important part of the app is that there are a lot of people out there who are experiencing a lot of hard things that they don't know how to express themselves or to other people. And the app is designed to help with both sides of that, to help people really first and foremost in sort of a short form journaling format, kind of find themselves with themselves. And then secondly, to the extent that they have somebody safe in their lives that they can share that with to continue that conversation, to put that out there to them and see where it goes.
And people can find it at Google Play. People can find it on Apple. I feel like coding is the new language of the new love language. I feel like everyone should know it.
Totally agree. And especially given the fact that you and I tend to work in traditionally underserved areas, right? The information economy is a powerful tool for people who live 3 hours from Walmart, right? The information economy opens up all sorts of opportunity for you. A book I would recommend is called The $100 Startup. It's written by a guy named Chris Gilliaboo. And I can't begin to spell that last name, but that was really inspiring for me, $100 Startup. And he's got a lot of stuff out there. That was some of his early work, but that was really motivating for me to think differently about what my capacity is, because I think it's really easy for people to define themselves by who they aren't and define themselves by what they don't have. And when you can escape that and understand that you are exactly the person that somebody needs to talk to. You have almost exactly the skill set to make a difference in somebody's life, to make a difference in somebody else's organization, to meet a need in a community. Once you can come to grips with your value, then it's just a matter of stretching yourself out and seeing all the beautiful places you fit. And I love doing that work personally and myself, and I love helping other people do that work too.
I wanted to ask you three quick questions. It's not questions we ask everyone, but just to get to know Mick just a little bit more, since we've talked about your background a little bit, if you're open to that.
I'm an open book for you, Will.
All right. Three quick questions. Since you are a domestic traveler, what's the favorite place you've been?
Oh, my goodness. We have this conversation all the time and rarely come up with a simple answer. As far as national parks are concerned, Yosemite is magnificent. Like, you see the rock climbing documentaries and different things. The thing I didn't understand till I got there is it's all within like a couple miles. Like, it's just all right there.
Oh wow, I had no idea.
I love the desert. There's something about the desert Southwest that speaks to my soul, which is part of the reason why it's such a delight for us to be where we are in San Juan County right now. My wife loves the mountains. You know, we love Central America. You said domestically, though. I wish I could give you a certain destination. Here's the truth. The most beautiful place that you will find is the place where you can sit down at peace with yourself and find somebody else there who you connect with. That's the truth of it. And if that happens in front of a waterfall, then waterfalls are going to be your new favorite thing. And if that happens at the Grand Canyon, then the Grand Canyon is going to be your new favorite thing. And if that happens in, you know, the rainforest or in the Pacific Northwest, then the Pacific Northwest is going to be your new thing. But it's partly about the scenery. It's mostly about the experience.
Makes a whole lot of sense. Another quick question. You described yourself as a foodie or someone that likes to eat, especially interesting food. One, what's the best meal you've ever had? And have you come across one of the best restaurants you've ever eaten at in your travels?
Right. So I don't want to misrepresent myself. When I think foodie, I think of a person who has like this technical appreciation of like the finer culinary points of life. And I'm probably not that guy. I'm the guy who has. I'm the guy who's munched on a grill fired toad on the outer edge of an island Buddhist temple in Vietnam. Like, that's more my, you know, that's more my culinary adventure self. I love Indian food. Any place that has a real tandoori oven is a place that is probably going to produce some really, really great food. But at the same time, I love foods that speak to my experience. I literally cried in a strip mall Vietnamese restaurant in Denver, Colorado recently, just because they brought out this cup of true Vietnamese coffee, which is a whole different conversation. And just sitting there drinking that and the memories that come with that for me. I don't know that it's about the food. It's about the exposure. It's about the experience. It's about knowing that we are all out there being us. And that brings me joy.
Wanted to ask you this, since we talked about food. We ask a lot of people this, not everyone, but cornbread or biscuits?
Oh, cornbread. Oh, what kind of question is that, Will?
All right. Now,
I will say this, though. I believe that biscuits and gravy are almost a Southern form of magic. Right. But I have, alas, developed a pretty wicked dairy allergy, so I can't do real biscuits and gravy anymore. So since I can't do biscuits and gravy, I mean, biscuits by themselves can't hang compared to cornbread and all the things you can do with cornbread.
I like it, especially in regards to beans, ham. And
oh,
two questions that we do ask everyone, and I wanted to ask you, I wanted to bring it back a little bit to the region where I call home, or the region where I'm from. What's the first thing you think about when I say the word Appalachia?
Ale 8.
That's the first time we've ever had that answer. Not a lot of people know that. I appreciate that. How did you?
Oh, I love me some ALA. I ended up in Indiana in college for a while. Took my first outdoor rock climbing trip to the Red River Gorge of Kentucky.
Nice. Yes.
Was exposed to AL8, and to this day, every time I can get my hands on it, man, when we were in that part of the country, we stuffed our fridge probably three times over with every bit of AL8 I could find.
Nice, nice. That's a perfect answer because, like I said, not a lot of people, especially from outside the region, understand the AL8 importance in Appalachia. One last question that I wanted to ask you. And I'm going to ask this in a different way because I read a little bit on your blog, on your website about how you reference home. Because we ground our podcast on place and perspective. A lot of times we ask people just where they call home, what makes it home for them, what makes it unique. But I read that you think that people think about home in two different ways. One, home is where the heart is or kind of where they're from. Two, home is where they hang their hat or where they are at the moment. But you've looked at it at a kind of interesting and little different way. You suggest there's a third train of thought. Home is being about, not necessarily being about the past or the present. It should be where you're headed or the future. Can you talk about that a little bit of what you meant by that?
That's a really good question, Will. That, and full disclosure, that comment is at least to some degree born of pain for me. Being a first generation escapee of poverty and being a part of a family that moved literally to do that, like every 3 years, we're in a new place, a new job. One of the misconceptions that I developed about where I was from was that there was something wrong with it. Related to that, that there was something wrong with me because I was a part of it. So home as a place of sort of a source of origin has been a thing that I ran from for decades. And that's just been a part of my own healing journey to have to come to grips with that, to go back to those places and feel my own feelings and look around and see that they're actually beautiful, that there's nothing wrong with who I was and nothing wrong with where I'm from, even though we had to leave it to escape some things we need to escape. So as a result of that, the truth is that I feel homeless. Like I feel more at home in this camper that I can hook up my F-350 and be out of here in 15 minutes. I feel more at home in this camper than I have probably felt anywhere in my life. And I don't relish that. Like I see people who the word home means something to them. You know, my mom says the word home, she is referencing an 80-acre peanut farm in Southwest Oklahoma, right? And I think that's beautiful. And I don't feel that at all. And so it's a space of longing for me. And I think maybe that's why for me, I really resonate with that idea that home is maybe where we're headed, right? It's partly a theological thing, sort of there's this kingdom of truth and light and love that is here, but not here. And we're there, but we're on the way there. And that's beautiful and important to me, but it also gives me hope that maybe, just maybe, someday I will roll into Paducah, Kentucky, or, you know, somewhere, and I'll be home, not just with the dirt, but like with myself, with you, with all of it. And I crave that.
Thank you so much for being on the inaugural ERC guest podcast episode for our show. Thank you for the work that you're doing, for serving with the IADC, for working in San Juan County, Utah, a place that you are now. And thank you so much for being here.
Good stuff, Will. Thank you for having me. And you are a heck of a guy, and Appalachia is blessed to have you.
I was down, but now I'm up. Yeah. This all God, this ain't no luck. Yeah. I used to be stuck in that mud. Yeah, I was down, but now I'm up, 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 up. I was down, but now I'm up. Yeah, it's all God is saying.
Man, we meet all kinds of interesting characters, Will. Mick seems like a phenomenal human, great person,
and, you know, obviously does some great works. So honored to get the opportunity to speak with him. I'm glad we got a chance to catch up with him. And honestly, I'm looking forward to the next fellow that comes on.
Yeah, definitely want to thank Mick again for taking the time. And it was good to just hear his backstory of why he got into the work that he does now, being a pastor for many years. He mentioned his faith is really important to him. But also, before he started the fellowship, what he was doing with his family for the last, you know, couple of years, traveling around the country in an RV, and just to hear his experience and takeaways from the different communities, and how, bottom line, one of the most positive things that he mentioned was the great people that he met at every and has met at every stop. And it just reemphasizes the fact that with all the divisiveness that's going on in the country, in the end, we're all good people or want to be good people. And you'll meet good people in all these regions wherever you go, regardless of the challenges. And I just wanted to mention that and thank him again.
Yeah, well, I was thinking when he was telling us about the experience, I was thinking, man, how many times or how many people in life think about what he actually picked up and did? I mean, I think we all have that idea out there in our head, like, let's travel the country with our family in an RV with no end date and time in place. And, you know, it's one thing to think about it. It's another to actually do it. So mad props to him and his family, and super jealous.
Yeah, I know, right?
Well, Will, in conclusion, like we always do, is there a at biz of the week that you want to give a shout out to this week?
Yeah, since it's a long episode, I want to mention quickly just an at biz of the week that we had. And because it's Derby week, because it's the greatest 2 minutes in sports tomorrow, the experience of a lifetime. If you've never been to Derby, put it on your bucket list. You should definitely go. But two things that we mentioned even in the intro that is associated with Derby: bourbon and horses. So we mentioned the mint julep, but one at biz I wanted to mention, it's called Horse Soldier Bourbon. They've been trained by some of the best distilleries in Kentucky. They just are about to open their future facility in Somerset, Pulaski County, Kentucky. That's Eastern Kentucky, right there in Appalachia. We talked about the Moonshine Trail last week. Well, this will now be part of that bourbon trail to bring people not only from central Kentucky, but on down there into eastern Kentucky. Some might say the end of the bourbon trail. I like to say it's the beginning of the bourbon trail. So we want to give a shout out to Horse Soldier. They got a really cool story around the military aspect and background that the owners have in regards to the name Horse Soldier. It's woven into the fabric of America's most historic moments. Just days after 9/11, elite teams of Green Berets were inserted into Afghanistan, some on horseback, dubbed the Horse Soldiers. So that's where they get their name, and they're proudly planted right there in eastern Kentucky. So I want to give them a shout out. We'll post it in the show notes. If you want to try some bourbon to mix in your mint julep, check it out, Horse Soldier.
Yeah. Glad you mentioned that. It does have a little bourbon in it, but it's hard to find with all those mints. Anyway, another great episode, Big Willie. Thanks for your time, man. Good talking to you.
Same to you. Hope to have you back again next week. Neil, I know you're going on a big vacation. We'll see if we can get you on. I want to thank Mick again, and I guess we can end it like we usually do. Till next time.
Peace.